General Loydern, Reel 3. You were just saying that you'd returned to Kufra and that there was a great mass of long-range desert group people there.
We had only just been there a day or two when the Germans sent over 6 Heinkels to come and bomb the place because the GHQ communique had done exactly what we had asked them not to do. They announced that these raids had taken place and had been mounted from Kufra. Specifically, had we implored them not to mention this. However, over they came, and they bombed and strafed the place for an hour or so, during which time all these SAS and LRDG let off every weapon that they had, and by God, there were a lot of weapons down there at that moment. 6 came over of these Heinkels, and 4 failed to get back, which was pretty creditable with small arms. I happened to have been standing, watching one of these beautiful-looking things spitting fire into the palm trees where I was with my patrol when I was bowled over by a 0.5 kind of size thing out of one of these aircraft and shot through the back and my left elbow. Well, that damaged me very considerably, and I was eventually flown back to Cairo, where I spent the next few months in hospital recovering from this damage.
Can you tell me how the desert campaign ended, as far as you were concerned, after you came out of hospital?
Well, I managed to get back to the desert just before it did end, and I got command of my patrol again, which had been taken over meanwhile by another officer, and I did one more small operation of reconnaissance with them before the 8th Army joined up with the 1st Army and the whole of North Africa was cleared in April of 1943.
Did you continue with the Long Range Desert Group after the desert campaign ended?
Well, there was quite a bit of problem as to what was going to happen to us. There had been a considerable comings and goings to Cairo from Colonel Prendergast and Jake Eason Smith, who was by this time second in command, and they had been talking about the future role of the Long Range Desert Group. There was no question about it that the staff did not want to see us disbanded. I think there is no doubt that it had been a very effective and probably a cost-effective unit. It was never more than 250, 300 at the most. And the disruption that it had caused to enemy communications, the information that it had provided, and the role that it had operated in as taxis for agents, SAS, and a whole lot of other organizations, such as escape and evasion organizations, had proved its worth in a very big way. So they didn't want to see us disbanded, but the problem was what we were going to do. But eventually, it was decided that we would go on into Europe operating on our feet or, if we could get through the lines, in jeeps and for a limited period only. It was never envisaged that we would operate for more than about 10 days before we were resupplied either by air or by sea, and therefore we were withdrawn back to Alexandria. And we set about retraining, reorganizing, and working out methods for our new role. I stayed with them, fortunately. I wanted to stay with them. I'd enjoyed it enormously. And once I saw that there was a role, I decided to stay with them. And I was fortunate in that Jake Eason Smith was made second in command, and we reorganized so that we had 2 squadrons. One was a New Zealand squadron, and the other was the remnants of the Long Range Desert Group. The Brigade of Guards withdrew their patrols because they'd had very heavy casualties in Tunisia and couldn't afford to reinforce them. And we were left with the Yeomanry and with the Rhodesians and various other parts of the organization, like our heavy supply section, which we turned into patrols, those who were suitable, and I was given command of B Squadron of the Long Range Desert Group in April of 1943, and took them up to the Cedars of Lebanon, where we camped at 7,000 feet or thereabouts, and had wonderful skiing and mountain facilities to train for our new role.
Can you tell me more about what that new role was going to be exactly?
It was largely going to be based on similar lines of what we had been doing in the desert, and that was reconnaissance, not only on the coast, reporting on the movements of shipping, but reporting on movements of aircraft from airfields, and also it was to provide communication links with partisans and other friendly forces in the Balkans and northern Italy. It was something for which we had to completely change our method of approach to the target. We retained a capability of being able to take offensive action, but we obviously had to retrain totally. In that we had to learn to parachute into our target. We had to work with the Royal Navy in order to go in by submarine or by fast motor launch or to be landed, air-landed at strips already prepared by partisans with British liaison officers and teams, which there were existing in Yugoslavia and Greece and other places at that time.
Where did you go to after the Lebanon? After the Lebanon, where did you go to?
After the Lebanon, where we spent, I think it was until about September. It was early September of 1943. We'd gone up then about May. We were sent off to the Aegean, to the Dodecanese, to take part in what I can only describe as a ghastly disaster of an operation which really should never have taken place. It was a great bee in the bonnet of Winston Churchill to bring Turkey into the war. And we were sent up there in conjunction with other forces. 234 Brigade, which had been in Malta, was brought up to Leros. And the whole idea was to occupy these islands after the surrender of the Italians. They surrendered, I think it was on the 13th September or thereabouts, or early September of 1943. The whole idea was to occupy these islands before the Germans could, so that we could encourage the Turks to come into the war with us. Well, that was a lovely ideal, but without any airfields available to support these forces, it was totally impossible for us to have continued up there with the threat, which was pretty constant, of German aircraft operating from Greece and from Rhodes, which we had not taken ourselves. As a result, in November of 1943, after a five-day and very bloody battle, the Germans took Leros, and there were we, as well as a whole brigade, and we lost something like over 100 men were missing at the end of that operation. Now, this should never have been allowed to take place. We should never have been on an island of that sort committed to an infantry battle. There was no air support of any sort. The Royal Navy did valiantly and had, by the time the island fell, already lost one-third of the Mediterranean fleet. And, as I say, there was a whole brigade that was captured on that island. It was, the less I say about the disaster, that battle, I think the better, because I feel very strongly that it was ill thought out from start to finish, and it never should have been allowed to take place as it did. Anyhow, I was fortunate in that I got out of Leros just before the battle started in an Italian submarine, which I think was one of the nastiest experiences I have ever had in my life, because it was putrid, stinking. They were terrified. I practically had to stand behind the commander of the ship a lot of the time, because he was so frightened of being bombed. They had very nasty experiences, we all had, up in the Aegean, but it was not something I enjoyed. However, by that time, when Leros had fallen, Jake Eason Smith, who had taken over during, or just before the battle, taking over command of the Long Range Desert Group, he was killed carrying out a patrol on the island on his feet a few hundred yards away from our headquarters at the height of the battle. He was killed. Guy Prendergast had handed over to him because he'd been promoted, and I was at that stage second in command. We had suffered quite considerably. We'd lost about a third of our total strength. That was in itself bad enough, but the New Zealand government were very, very upset that the men from the New Zealand Expeditionary Force had been involved in this totally abortive operation. They then decided to withdraw our New Zealanders, of which we had a whole squadron from the Long Range Desert Group. General Freyberg was ordered to take them away. He had been a great supporter of the Long Range Desert Group from start to finish. Indeed, we at one stage even had his son with us serving as a patrol commander. But they were withdrawn from us, and we had therefore a double blow, having lost all the men that we had already lost. But a great number of them managed to escape either through Turkey or escaped in Athens on the way out of trains on the way through to Germany. A great number of them got back, and I suppose in the end we lost something like 50 taken prisoner. So we were extremely lucky.
Where did you go to next?
Well, after that disaster, I was fortunate in that I was the senior officer left, and so I was appointed to command the Long Range Desert Group, the last of four who did command it during its 5 years of history. And we got ourselves back into southern Syria on the borders of Palestine, where we reorganized, retrained, re-equipped, and I replaced the New Zealand squadron with a whole squadron of Rhodesians, which I was extremely fortunate to get at that time. But it so happened that the then air minister from Rhodesia was coming through, and he came to visit our Rhodesians, and he persuaded his Rhodesian government to let us have a whole squadron of Rhodesians. Well, we reformed, we recovered ourselves, picked ourselves up, and we went off to Italy and set up headquarters on the east coast of Italy, just above the big Foggia airfields on the Gargano Peninsula, which sticks out towards across the coast there on the right-hand side, and was an admirable place for us to operate and communicate into the Balkans and northern Italy. And we, this, I suppose, was about April of 1944 when we arrived in Italy, and we then carried out a whole series of operations, not only in northern Italy, but mostly in Yugoslavia, Albania, Greece, and all that littoral to the east of Italy.
How did you find that the unit adapted to non-desert conditions?
Oh, it adapted very well. We had men who were very adaptable. Not only that, but we had inevitably to get rid of a certain number who were not going to be suitable. Not very many, but there were some who weren't going to be suitable to parachute, for example. After Leros, we had a very big shakeout because we had lost a large number of men, and therefore we recruited a whole lot of others. But on the whole, they took to it remarkably well. They were used to operating on their own. They liked operating on their own. They were happy, whether it was in mountains or whether it was in desert, being left to get on with a job, and they were glad when things went right. And I think it wasn't difficult for any of them. I think the best ones that we had left towards the end had had a great deal of experience, and they would adapt to almost anything. Indeed, when the war did finally come to an end, we very nearly went out to the Far East, and I feel quite certain that we would have continued operating out there happily with a little bit of time to retrain, just as we did after retraining when we got to Italy for the new role there. We had a different method altogether. It was bound to be, I think. We operated a great deal by parachute, being dropped into places. More often than not, we were lifted out, and therefore there was a great deal of by sea. There was a great deal of walking involved. You had to be extremely fit to cover hundreds of miles in that Balkan country in all climates. So the winters were very, very, very severe. And although we were by then beginning to get much better equipment, because we were getting American equipment, when we first started operating in the mountains in Syria, for instance, on training, we hadn't anything other than ghastly British battle dress to live in feet deep of snow. And that was hopeless. But the Americans, of course, did have excellent equipment, and we were fortunate, and we could get a lot of that.
Did you find that operating under conditions where there was a much denser population than North Africa had a big effect on what you were doing?
Oh, yes. It totally changed the whole thing because, for two reasons, really. Firstly, you were involved politically, inevitably. The political complications of working, as I was commanding this organization, with patrols in northern Italy, with patrols in Yugoslavia, in patrols in Albania, and patrols in Greece. And in Albania and Yugoslavia, there were the two factions, of course, the partisans and the royalists, both of whom pretended or thought that they were fighting the Germans. They were largely more interested in fighting themselves. There was that big problem to start with, the political one. And secondly, there was the big problem of being amongst people who were not always likely to be friendly. And therefore you had this awful worry the whole time as to whether you would be given away. On the whole, I think we were extremely lucky. We were given away, I think, once or twice, but I think most of the time we had sufficient money available to us in the form of golden sovereigns with which we were able to bribe, or cigarettes, or whatever it was. We took a great number of cigarettes, sovereigns, and other bribe-worthy goods with us on these operations. After all, these poor people in Albania, where I was myself later on, they were living absolutely on the breadline. And we would be glad, if we could, to help them in any way that was possible. They were short of food, and we were short of food. And if we did try and buy food off them, and we lived on turkeys for quite a long time, we used to pay them handsomely in golden sovereigns, and that was worth a lot of money to them.
How did the political differences have an impact on you?
Oh, they had enormous impact because one was awfully involved in their own political aims. There was the problem, for instance, when I was in Albania, there were the two factions there. There was Enver Hoxha, who later became the prime minister, and to whom we had a big mission, with whom we had a big mission. And there was Abbas Kupi, who was the ex-royalist man, and whom the British were not so keen to support because he wasn't fighting the Germans to the same extent as Abbas Kupi wanted to. Abbas Kupi wanted to fight the communists. We, therefore, the whole time had to take care of what we were doing. And in Yugoslavia, towards the end of things up there, when we were getting too near Trieste, the Tito and his partisans were terribly anxious that we were going to try and get to Trieste before he did. Therefore, he would lose his claims on Trieste. In fact, they even went to the extent of arresting some of our people operating in Yugoslavia because they hadn't got passes written by the local divisional commander or whatever it was to allow us into the country. Well, these were trumped-up excuses, purely because there were political reasons why they wanted to get to Trieste or Fiume or Pola or whatever it might be before we did, so that they would lay a claim to it when the whole settlement of the peace came in the future. No, politically, it was a most trying and difficult time. And when you're fighting with your hand tied behind your back for political reasons, it is not a lot of fun. And I was the pawn between Field Marshal Alexander's headquarters and my people on the ground. And I was trying to maintain a reasonable amount of security for them, which was jolly difficult. When they were being arrested or moved from unwillingly or their hiding place given away, when they were doing a marvelous job reporting shipping running up and down the coast, which within a few minutes would be sunk by the RAF because we could get the RAF over to sink them.
Did you actually meet Enver Hoxha?
No, I never did. I never did myself. No, I met his number two, a man called marvelous, rough character called Muslim Peza, who was the vice president of Albania for many years. They were very rugged characters. Enver Hoxha I never did meet, but he remained president of Albania for many years and only died in the last few years. They were marvelous, wild, rugged brigands, as tough as hell. Their word was not very good. I never quite knew whether they would carry out what I'd asked them to do or whether they would move off in the middle of the night and leave us. And they did, every now and again. And here again, I can remember so well how when we were getting near Tirana, which was their capital, they were much more interested in going into Tirana in order to get what loot they could than standing and staying with us and destroying Germans moving towards Tirana because they wanted to be rid of them as soon as they could out of their country. This, of course, is quite understandable, but what I was trying to do was to destroy Germans as much as we could. And there are a large number of Germans in the Balkans at that time, 18, 20 divisions. And I wanted to see that as few of those could be allowed to withdraw back into Europe, into the redoubts or wherever it was that they were going, rather than let them go free, which, of course, was very understandable. The Albanians, the sooner they could get rid of them, the better. I got to know some of those Albanians very well as you possibly could, with the language difficulties and everything else. They were extremely kind to me when I damaged myself rather badly when I was dropped in there. They were not reliable. They were frightfully attractive rogues.
What was so attractive about them?
They had a great charm, a great sense of humour. They were very, very good countrymen, wonderful fighters, and they didn't care a damn for the Germans in any possible way. They were brave as lions, and they'd suffered an awful lot over the years. They were brutal, they were horrible. They treated the Italians who had occupied that country I can't remember when, but they occupied it before the war, and they treated those Italians who were in Albania just like slaves. They had no more prisoner of war rights than the man in the moon. They were treated like slaves, and I saw them being treated like slaves, fed on the minimum amount of food, and and made to work all hours of the day and night. Well, we weren't particularly sorry, I will own, because we were not terribly fond of the Italians ourselves. But it was a pretty savage existence in those countries, but they were attractive devils.
Which of the Balkan countries did you prefer to personally to operate in?
Well, I was only in Yugoslavia in a very minimal kind of way. I was dropped into Albania. I damaged myself badly on landing, and therefore I was only there for a very short time. But the short time that I was there, I saw quite a bit of the country, and I covered quite a bit of distance. I had to in order to get out of the country. It wasn't easy. But a very kind doctor, my regimental doctor, Michael Parsons, was dropped in to me, and with his help and another medical orderly of his, we walked out and we saw a lot of the country, but we also, en route, were involved with a lot of negotiations and a lot of one or two minor operations with the partisans. I loved that country. Yugoslavia, I didn't really know at all well. Most of the time, of course, myself, I was controlling operations from Italy. This was my job. I was commanding the unit, and I had patrols stretched out over a frontage from the south of Greece, the Peloponnese, up to northern Italy, over a frontage of 800 and nearly 900 miles over all those different various Balkan countries. I think, if you ask me, really, I enjoyed Albania enormously, and I say it still, although I've never been allowed to go back, and nor has any European been allowed to go back to that country. Oh, no, other people from the Western Europe have gone back, or very few have ever since. I would love to go back and see it. I think I'd be disappointed in lots of ways now.
How did your work with the Desert Group finally end?
Well, it ended in a rather sad way, I think. As we were getting nearer and nearer towards Trieste, and the partisans were getting nearer and nearer towards Trieste, and the Allied forces in Italy were getting nearer and nearer, I had various patrols, quite a number of men, in the Istrian Peninsula, which is the bit that sticks out south at the top of the Dalmatian coast. And they were up there operating largely and in giving information on shipping that was moving up and down. They were working most effectively, and we had a wonderful system of communication back to my headquarters, which at that stage was in Yugoslavia. I'd moved an advance headquarters into Yugoslavia at a place called Zara. We had a marvelous system whereby they could send sightings of ships back over the air to us, and within half an hour, if they were available, RAF aircraft could be over those ships, and they would sink them without